Hello, Heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Heroes, just a reminder that I will be at Big Bad Con in Oakland, California, from October 14th through the 16th. I'm just going to be hanging out and playing games, so if you're around, come and say hi. It's another live episode, this time with Hakanse Aliolu of Thorny Games, who you might know from Dialect and Sign, games that I have talked a lot about on this podcast because I love them. We had a very cozy chat, and also it kind of sounds like we, I don't know, kicked the microphone a bunch of times. I've done what I can, and I promise that you will enjoy it anyway. So let's jump right in. What have you been playing lately that you're really excited about?
Yeah, the games that I've been playing the most lately, I think I've been playing a lot more Freeform lately. And so I've been really excited about a lot of the games that are kind of doing new and interesting things there. One of the highlights for like all of last year for me was when I got a chance to play Old Friends.
Right? Oh, you played Old Friends?
Back at Dreamation, and that was such a blast.
I'm actually running that for my home group very soon.
And really?
I'm like so excited. Uh-huh. Yeah.
When's that gonna happen?
I don't know. October, the spooky month.
Yeah, the spookiest of all the months.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, it was really, really great. Got to play it with some really great people, and just having that whole like mask possession thing.
Yeah.
Like how masks affect us in general is kind of a fascinating thing.
Right? Mask work is very, very powerful, mm-hmm. like frighteningly powerful.
Yep.
For any of our listeners who don't know, you've played it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What is Old Friends about?
So Old Friends is about a group of former Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. The last job you did together, something went terribly wrong, and one of you died. And you've never come back together. It happened in this room, in the convention center, or wherever you're playing it. And you get back together for one final job. And that job is to exorcise your fallen friend. Okay. The central mechanic and the way that you get possessed during the game, or the way you channel any ghosts, is by picking up this mask in the middle of the room. So the instruction is kind of whenever there's a lull in activity, you pick up this mask and you put it on. And at that point, you know, through some cards, you figure out how you're possessed. This could be any variety of things that I would hate to spoil.
Sure, sure. Moment, yeah.
Right? But they're all very dynamic, very fun, and a lot of times very, very emotional and very, very deep, right? And so that was probably my... I had to like point out one like real highlight.
Yeah, the 2016 game.
Yeah, it was just such a defining experience for me. It was really the point where like I knew LARP was going to have a very, very special place in my heart, and really kind of gave me that appreciation for like how many new crazy techniques are out there.
Yeah. Right. Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love when someone uses a technique or a mechanic like that that just feels like it's kind of opening a gate a little bit, mm-hmm. like. Whoa, if that guy's doing that, let's go bananas. Like,
yeah, there's just so much more you can do with it. And all I want to do is just keep playing with that and do other crazy things with masks.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And it's so dynamic. And I just love that, like, you know, you see that or you see that in Juggernauts where it's just, they're very built-in ways to, like, inject action and inject like the next step of the narrative.
Yeah.
And that was something that I found really, really special in that game, because I also had a lot of games that, you know, you play for a little bit and then there's a lull or you're not quite sure how to take it to the next level. So those games with kind of that mm-hmm. built-in way to do that mm-hmm. Are very, very interesting to me and something that I found like really special about the experience.
I just played in John Cole's Games Within Games, which is like a spy, like Cold War spy story.
Mm-hmm.
And it uses the avatar system where two people are playing one character
mm-hmm.
and one person sort of plays like their external like expressions and actions and words, and the other person represents their internal experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was the cover. I was like the external stuff. And you have one person who's like basically standing behind you, whispering in your ear the entire time,
mm-hmm.
which I thought like, oh, is that going to be like distracting or confusing? Will it be a challenge? But it's actually so nice mm-hmm. to be in a role-playing situation. And if you can't think of something, they just like tell you stuff and you can like, you know, just like thoughts, you can ignore it or you can do whatever about it. But it ends up being like, oh yeah, that's good. I'm going to use that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, one game that I've heard about that I really want to play that I believe is still under development. What's it? It's It's a noir-focused game where someone's the detective, someone's their hat, and someone's, like, I forget, like, their inner voice or something.
Oh, like the monologue, the classic noir monologue.
Exactly. And so the hat character is the one who does the monologue. The one actually controlling the character does their actions. And there's one more piece of this psyche that I'm forgetting now. That's
what,
also like
what is this game?
I forget. I'll have to look it up. I think it's still being developed. I don't know that it's publicly available yet. Mm-hmm. But there are also great things where, like, as far as I understand, if at any point, like, anyone around the table can, like, hand the detective a cigarette, then, like, they have to keep smoking that, and they cannot speak. Like, their character cannot speak. Only the hat may, like, monologue about their inaction.
While they're gazing at the window thing. And smoking. Exactly. Oh, that's so perfect.
And, like, someone might be yelling at them and telling them all about what horrible things are happening in the world, and all they can do is just stare and smoke. And the hat is just, like, dialoguing what's going on in their head, and it's like... And he just kept yammering at me. And all I could think of was the emptiness. And it's just so wonderful.
That's very fun.
Yeah, yeah. No, if only I could remember what it is, but we'll sure we can look it up.
That's what show notes are for.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about dialect and Sign, which you're releasing together this month.
Well, in a way, right? Okay. Because Sign is already available. It is free. It will always be free, right? That's very important for us with that game.
Totally.
Just because of the community that's represented, and we wouldn't feel right charging money for it.
Totally.
But along with dialect, we are going to do a short print run of it with all the money that would come into us through it going to the Nicaraguan Sign Language Project.
Cool.
But that is something that we'd like to do just because sometimes having a physical piece makes it easier to play, right?
Yes, yeah. And you could get that into the hands of people who wouldn't necessarily know where to find the PDF, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And you just hold on to this, and every time you want to play it, you don't have to go and, like, cut out stuff, right? You just have this available, toss in your bag, and if the right opportunity arises, you know, you get to play this little game. Mm-hmm. And so doing that is really important to us. And, of course, dialect, which we're kickstarting very, very soon.
When this shit drops, it's going to be on Kickstarter. And everyone just pause the show, stop what you're doing, go and back it. Because dialect, like, get as hype as I am, please.
Mm-hmm.
Give us the short form of what dialect is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the tagline for dialect is, it's a game about language and how it dies, right? It's a game where we thought about community, and we thought about what reflects the identity of the community. And the thing that really jumped out as us, as a topic that both we were really passionate about, and that we thought was a living, breathing, kind of vibrant embodiment of this, is language, mm-hmm. right? And so we want to take language and use that as the storytelling mechanism for a people. And this also has the really nice benefit. Well, it has a few really nice benefits. First, you'd be amazed at what your brain can do with language, right? In a lot of ways, I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say having a conversation like this is going to be the most impressive thing I do all day, right? Like, the way our brains handle just such complex flow and just let it come out completely unconsciously is so incredibly powerful. And the second reason being is when you create this language together and you actually speak it, this is something you get to share with your friends, right?
Yeah.
And you remember the words that you created around the table.
Oh, totally, totally. Mm-hmm. I played it at a con, and for the rest of the con, we would still use those words, like, with the people who I'd played with. Like, it's amazing how sticky that stuff is.
Oh, yeah, it's just totally in your brain. And it's all just this very, very special piece of our brain and what it means to be human that language really embodies, right? And that is really what drives our passion for the topic and what makes it such an important part of design for us. Because one other thing that I always like saying is I play games to be surprised by what I've accomplished, right?
Yeah.
One of the most satisfying things that I experience at the end of the game is looking back on and going, wow, I can't believe I did that, right? Like, I can't believe I told that story. I can't believe we came up with this rich world just around this table. And that feeling really drives me.
Mm-hmm.
And language, I think, is a place where we can't help but surprise ourselves.
Yeah. Right?
Where we just can't help but be amazed by how much we're able to hold in our head, how naturally we're able to grab onto these concepts, and how naturally we're just able to roll with them. So that's a way in which, like, I think it's a particularly relevant topic for exploration.
Cool, cool. Now, this is a game that has been in development for a long time. Probably not a long time as far as analog games go, but...
Yeah, not crazy. It's been a year, right? It was debuted at time.
Well, then that's actually a relatively short time. but what has been... This is your guys' first Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. When you've been thinking about how to put this game out into the world, like... How do you start thinking about that? And how do you make decisions about how it's going to be released and how it's going to exist and what you're going to put into it?
Absolutely. So one of the biggest topics that we've been thinking about with regards to this is we think that what we want to put into the world is both a game that people are going to be able to experience and have a great time with, but also the concept of language death and language birth is a really fruitful topic just for people to learn more about, and is naturally a very, like, engaging, passionate topic for tons and tons of people. Right? And so, with that, we want to make sure that, like, there's a lot that people will find interesting and fascinating in the book and the content itself, just around those topics. So that's been kind of a crucial component of thinking about how we're going to put it out into the world. And, yeah.
So, designing a game is one thing. I feel like publishing a game is almost kind of a completely separate set of skills.
Yes, it is. It very much is. It is definitely not what you think you're signing up for, I think, at the beginning.
What do you mean? Expand on that.
Well, I was actually lamenting this fact with someone at Origins. I was like, you know, I love the design process and I want to get out into the world. And so now we're going through this process, right? And there are some really wonderful places, like seeing art brought into your game is truly an amazing experience, right? But then there's shipping and publishing and all these other things that go into it, right? And so I brought this up to one of my friends and they were like, well, you know, if that is something that you're surprised by and somewhat disappointed by, you probably shouldn't have picked, you know, a hobby that had indie in the title, right? Because that's kind of like what you signed up for.
It's like, as I can, yeah,
you're right. It was kind of telegraphed that this was part of the process. And so I completely respect that and understand that. But it also does really make it so you're able to create your vision in a way that most other disciplines, or when you're interacting with a bigger publisher, you don't have the luxury of doing. Yeah. I was just talking to someone yesterday who told me they had sold their board game, or they had an offer for their board game idea from a really big publisher, like a publisher that would get it out everywhere. And I was like, that sounds amazing, right? It'll be all across the world. Everyone will be able to play it. And they're like, but I have no idea what they're going to do with my idea, right?
Whoa, that's frightening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the person was legitimately, like, and understandably scared by this. They said, you know, we'll sign a contract, they'll agree to a certain part of proceeds, but they're going to deconstruct the whole thing. And maybe they'll keep the core idea, but I don't know how they're going to treat it. I don't know that they're going to make a game that I'd be proud of at the end of it. And they're not even going to associate my name with the product, right, in a lot of ways. And that's super scary.
Yeah. Right?
And that is something really, really special. By being able to, like, control the artwork, control the publication, you get to really make sure that this is something you feel proud of by the time it gets out there. And something that you can also make sure that it gets to the right people, right? You can make sure that people who feel passionate about it are going to get it. And you don't necessarily have to worry about just getting the biggest distribution or the biggest, like, chunk of the market or anything, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's something that's really, really meaningful for us, that it gets to the right people.
Who do you think is going to find and pick up this book?
We think that Dialect actually has a really natural, or really all of our games have a really natural audience, right? It's like, if you love telling stories, and you think language is kind of a fascinating thing, like a fascinating, magical thing, this is going to be right up your alley. In a lot of ways, it is a game that asks you to do something that you're going to be very, I think, amazed and impressed with at the end. But it is something that, it is a game that's going to ask something of you, right? It's going to ask you to contribute creatively. It's going to ask you to really help build this thing together. And it by putting those expectations is going to allow you to create something that's truly yours and truly fascinating. Mm-hmm. And there is definitely a certain group of people, I think, that isn't necessarily what you're looking for, right? If you're looking for a much more, like, relaxing, laid-back experience, well, that might not be the best way to put it, but, like...
Something that you can easily just jump in and jump out of. And exactly. Just low-key, you know, the entertainment is sort of you just accept it, and it's, like, passive. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, you play for half an hour. Yeah, the passive actually is a really good way of putting it, because I know that one of the most kind of glaring pieces of bad feedback we got at some point was someone whose main experience with creative games had been, I think, Cards Against Humanity. And their biggest regret in it was Cards Against Humanity kind of is funny for you in a lot of ways, is what they had told us. Like, you get the cards, you just make the matches, you put them down. And they really lamented the fact that in this game, like, we asked you to build something, and we asked you to kind of contribute that. And that is definitely something we do, and is something that's, like, part of the expectations in order to create something amazing.
Yeah, and, like, I can really see getting... I would be driven mad by that feedback. Like, mm-hmm. your game is not enough like Cards Against Humanity. Nope. Like, I would just be driven to... I would be very upset by that. But it sounds like you've accepted, that feedback for what it actually is, which is, like, make sure that you tell people that this is a game where you will be contributing. Mm-hmm. I like that you've turned it into a lesson about setting expectations rather than just like a, man, fuck this nonsense.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
maybe that was your initial impression and then you were like, whoa, let's take a second.
That one in particular took us a little time to process because we really weren't expecting that.
Right? Yeah.
We were coming from a certain community, certain people who had a certain amount of exposure to RPGs before, people who were willing to put in the creative energy. And when we got that piece of feedback and then we realized that, like, okay, this is actually not an insignificant portion of people who would be out looking for stuff who might have the similar creative, like, requirements.
Yeah.
And that led to a lot of introspection on us and really let us more define what it is we were creating and what we wanted the game to be able to make and what it would ask of players, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's really where that came from.
Ah, that's so nice. What a lovely story.
Oh, yeah. That's really just a story of happiness.
I've seen the stacks and stacks and stacks of feedback that you guys had for Dialect. Mm-hmm. Like, I really, really like that you have a very specific sheet that you ask playtesters to fill out, and you have very specific questions, and you have people fill out, just write down whatever their impression was before they start talking about it. But so it's wonderful to have that much feedback to work from, but it must also be very intimidating to just have this gigantic, like, several feet high stack of papers of, like, here's some opinions about your game.
In a lot of ways it is, but in a lot of ways it is also kind of the best creative prompt you could hope for when you're stuck. Like, just going through those when there's a certain piece of design that you're really struggling with and just being able to flip through those papers and be like, okay, I'm going to ignore a lot of this, but I want to jar thoughts about the game back into my head. It's a really effective way to do that. And you're just going through and you're like, oh, someone actually brought up this topic and mentioned this, like, clunky bit about this thing and maybe had this random thought. Mm-hmm. It's a really good way to get your own creative energies flowing again. Which was an unexpected benefit for me. That wasn't something I was expecting of getting from it. But Kate and I both work in settings where we do interact a lot with user research. And so that was one of the primary ways in which we came about developing our system for feedback and making sure that that was a very integral part of our playtests.
Tell me about putting together that playtest feedback sheet. What were you working from in terms of knowing what you wanted to hear from people?
Mm-hmm. And knowing what you want to hear from people and deciding before you go into a testing environment, I think is one of the most important things that having a feedback sheet makes you do. Right? And so just asking yourself that question and making sure that you're not getting too sidetracked by the observations you make during gameplay is very, very important. Right? Mm-hmm. This happens all the time in user research where someone will see a user interacting with a product like maybe a product manager will see it and immediately overcorrect because one person misunderstood something and that one person was the one person they were watching. Right. So if you're not being very disciplined about, okay, these are the things that I know are clunky. These are the things I'm trying to get signal on. Just those natural outliers in every test you have mm-hmm. will cause you to overcorrect in random ways, I think, or at least divert analytic energies in very different ways.
Yeah.
So definitely just the fact that Mavis asked those questions up front was super, super important. And then it also gave us just certain other benefits. Having a feedback sheet really made it so that you could solicit feedback before people got a chance to talk to each other about the game, which immediately, I think, congeals people's opinions, right? Mm-hmm. People immediately hear what other people are saying, will naturally give other people the benefit of the doubt in a lot of ways, if that happens. Mm-hmm. And making sure that we were able to give people kind of a unmodified space in which they could be honest with us before hearing anything else was really important. Other than that, it just let us really think about the questions that we knew we wanted to ask in general, right? Because I think there are also good questions you can ask for feedback and bad questions you can ask for feedback.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy this game is probably a bad question to ask for feedback. But there are more effective ways of doing the same thing. And if you're in person, I think naturally asking something like that, something that's going to be a non-productive piece of feedback that people are going to, for example, be pressured into giving you a certain answer for.
Right, yeah.
Are going to be very unproductive.
So are your questions driven by, here's what we want out of the game? Or are the questions driven by, like, here's what we think might be wrong with the game? Mm-hmm. What makes you go like, oh, I really need to hear what people have to say about X? Mm-hmm.
There's a mix. So there's kind of one rotating question at the moment on the feedback sheet that we do change based on the thing that we're trying to focus on during that playtest session. So in previous things, it's been like, did you feel the amount of investment in your character paid off? Do you feel like the story progressed at the rate that you found fulfilling? Mm-hmm. And then we also have much more generic ones like, my favorite question to ask is always, and I didn't realize that this was kind of a children's game, I guess, but someone told me about this recently, your Rose and Thorn in an experience.
Right? Oh, yeah.
So this is the technique where you ask someone for the thing they most enjoyed and the thing they least enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And the point is, you don't really care about what they most enjoyed. Like, that's good to get, mm-hmm. but it's to make them more comfortable with kind of saying something mean about you. Because that's what you want.
Right, because people want to, even when you ask just the, like, what didn't you like, mm-hmm. they always want to couch it in, like, mm-hmm. yeah.
And they will. And they'll feel very uncomfortable giving you that feedback. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of very surprising how direct you can get feedback after you said, okay, tell me something really nice. Make me feel good.
Yeah.
And then they're like,
now
okay.
Just
and now
punch
just
me.
Slam me to the ground. and that really opens people up. And they're very happy to give you that after you've couched it in that way. Also kind of phrasing in that, like, non-threatening way. Like, what was your thorn? What kind of, like, you know, stuck in your side a little bit?
Right.
That's much more fun than, like, you know, what design elements were incomplete?
Or, yeah.
Like, how did I fail in my job as a designer?
Yeah. It also ties it to their experience. Not, like, what mm-hmm. was bad, but what stuck out for you? Or, like, what didn't work for you? Which mm-hmm. I think when people can own that, that's also much, much better.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It really gives them the freedom to say, this is what didn't work for me, but I don't know if that's a problem in design in the game.
Right. I wonder how culturally variable that is too. Mm-hmm. Like, I bet there are so many cultures where it's way more acceptable to just give negative feedback.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So many cultures where, like, you would have to, like, reverse that question, or like, oh, that would be amazing to see, like, how feedback is different across different kinds of cultures.
No, I definitely have gotten some in the past, and I won't name the country just because this may have been an outlier, but I remember playing this game and I was like, oh, that game went pretty well. And then I looked at this guy's feedback sheet and it was like, yo, needs a lot of work, did not have fun. It's like, everyone else at the table was like, yeah, we had fun, it went well.
Yeah.
And then it was just like, I think just being very blunt and being very critical, they felt like it was their job. And I really appreciate it. They had really great feedback.
Well, I mean, you just said, like, it's genuinely much more useful to hear what didn't work than what worked. So,
exactly. Yeah. And, you know, what worked can be nice to hear and will help you isolate the strong points of your game, too. Mm-hmm. But really, like, it's just a difficulty in getting the bad feedback
back. Right. So it's almost, it's more valuable almost because of rarity. Mm-hmm. Like, because, like, lots of people will say, like, oh, that was nice. But, mm-hmm. yeah.
And they'll tell you, like, what they enjoyed, too.
Yeah.
I'm like, I really enjoyed this part. And I was like, great, great. I've heard that 30 times before. Now, please tell me what didn't work, because yeah. that is kind of like pulling teeth sometimes.
And that's also what you need to take action on, mm-hmm. right? Like, keep feedback is like, okay, it's kind of, okay, good, done. Mm-hmm. Change feedback is like actually something you would do something about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And it is very important to realize, I think, when you're isolating the pieces that you're testing, it's lets you determine when you're done a lot quicker in a lot of ways, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think you will always get pieces of bad feedback. You yeah. will always find stuff that don't work. And you have to make certain decisions about which ones are intrinsic and which ones you just can't help.
Yeah.
Right? Which is a very difficult question to ask yourself, right? We've had this problem a lot where how do we deal with problematic players at the table? As first-time designers, or like people who just, not even strictly problematic, but people who just aren't building on other people's ideas, mm-hmm. right? People who aren't fun to play with because they're not listening to you, because yes. they're not trying to make the story between the both of you. Mm-hmm. And it's something we really struggled with. And at the beginning, we tried to incorporate a lot more mechanics around. But as we went more and more, we said, okay, this is kind of a fundamental thing.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like, games are about listening to each other. They're about that trust. They're about having that environment which will let you build something together. And we can facilitate that and we can encourage that in certain ways, but we can't make it happen every time.
You can't guarantee it.
Mm-hmm. You can't guarantee it, especially if certain people at the table aren't bought into making it happen.
Totally.
And being very honest about that with ourselves was a very difficult thing for us to do, because we knew that a lot of playtest sessions we would just have to be resigned to the fact that this might not go well.
Yeah.
And it's the places where you see it shine and you see the people who are really like wonderful together and they make something really amazing that we decided to build for.
Right.
And making sure that they just have the most wonderful experience possible when you have the circle of trust, when mm-hmm. you have this commitment to building something wonderful together, and knowing that that was what you were going to shine your microscope or shine your light on, right?
Totally.
Was really a crucial point, I think, in our design process.
So you have a background in mathematics and computer science, mm-hmm. and you're software developer. Mm-hmm. Is that the correct term? Software designer? Software engineer.
Software engineer is my official job title.
At Google.
Yes, yes. At YouTube.
But, yeah. At YouTube, mm-hmm. specifically. And yet you make analog games mm-hmm. and not digital games. What's the deal there? Break that down for me.
Interesting. Well, I actually did work in a lot of support positions for digital games. Like, I used to work in Google Play Game Services, which... it's like the Google equivalent of the Apple Game Center,
right.
if you're familiar with that. But overall, I really had a bit more of a love affair with analog as a medium, like really over the last like 5 years or so. Just being around people physically was a really, really wonderful thing to come into my life again.
Right, right.
That's not to say that I still don't love video gaming and digital gaming as a whole. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that really speaks more to me is when I'm able to be physically around people.
Right.
And so that really is what I've been focusing on.
And not just playing, but making, right? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, making digital games is, like, really lonely. Like, mm-hmm. really aggressively lonely work. Like, mm-hmm. especially, like, independently developing games.
Yeah.
It'd be, like, tremendously isolating. Mm-hmm.
And it's such a bigger commitment in terms of time development, too, right?
Really? Interesting.
Absolutely. Mm. Like, even most of the indie games you see will have taken, like, years and years to develop if they're video games. It's really, really unusual for a game to, like, for just that, like, one or two people are working on to be able to get out the door in, like, a year.
I've only ever made games with Twine and Game Maker, and they all took, like, significantly less than more like, I remember I made one in, like, 12 hours. But still, it's very, like, it's you and a computer screen, which if that's what you do all day at work, it's kind of the last fucking place you want to be.
Yeah, it's true. Well, I would say that, except that, you know, while I'm doing game design, I also end up staring at my screen for way too long, right?
All right.
But that's just kind of the lifestyle which I've resigned into, I guess, right? The perpetual proximity to a screen.
Which I feel like almost everyone, kind of no matter what your profession, it's now been.
Yeah, it is the de facto way in which you live.
Glowing rectangles. The primacy of the glowing rectangle.
That sometimes don't show the right color, and so you get really, really upset.
Oh, yeah! The beautiful, beautiful world of print design. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, the amount of, like, investment that I've had to put in to learn InDesign and different, like, layout techniques and stuff now this year too has been very unexpected.
That's so cool. I didn't know you guys are doing all the layout.
Well, not we're doing part of the layout for like stuff that was actually going to print, but for stuff like Golden Cobra submissions or stuff like prototypes, stuff like that, we've been doing layout ourselves
to make something that's workable and
and submittable and stuff
Of course. That's interesting. Are you doing anything for the Golden Cobras this year?
Oh, I wish. We'll see. It's still not past the deadline yet, right?
Yeah, you could.
Exactly. And actually, when we heard about last year for Sign, it was very, very close to the deadline, right?
Cool.
And you know, we had this wonderful idea to tell this story. But for this year, we've been just so focused on Dialect and Sign and bringing them up to production that we kind of made the conscious decision that if an idea really came to us, we would love to pursue it.
Yeah.
But other than that, it was really way scary to think of taking on another project
like that. To have three on the go.
Yeah, just on the burners at once. So.
Totally. But I'd like to ask you about your working relationship with your partner, because you two make all these games as a unit, and I'd like to ask you what are the challenges of making a game with your partner?
So there definitely are challenges, but really there are so many benefits of really like living and breathing the same air as the person that you're working with, like on such a regular basis, that if anything, it just gives me so much admiration for people who are able to do this, either through remote partnerships or on their own. Because for us, it's, we talk about it almost all the time. Like, we'll just go on a walk and we'll have a long conversation about one of the games. We'll just start talking about it in the living room. We'll be divvying up tasks like every night after work. And just having that level of really communication is extremely vital into the way we work. And when I think of doing that with someone, especially someone who I didn't have such a deep relationship with, I would be very scared. And
what's scary about that for you?
Well, to me in particular, I think having a safe space for my ideas is extremely important, right? Being able to experiment, being able to be wrong, being able to go back on things. And that's something that I can be very, very sensitive about. And it can be difficult to try to really do with someone you don't have a very intimate relationship with. And from that perspective, it has been really important for me to be able to do this with my partner.
Now, how does that translate to when you're playing an RPG? Which, like, if you're playing a collaborative story game, you really have to put yourself out there and put your ideas out there. I know that you love these games, but are they also incidentally terrifying for you?
No, not really. Because I, you know, before I start every game, I give the obvious spiel, right? I give that this is not a competition on being creative. This is not a reflection on who is the funniest, who is able to come up with the best ideas, right? And the reason why I always bring that up is because I believe in that. I believe that we're just trying to get all of our obvious worlds to, like, collide into each other head on and see what crazy, unexpected thing comes out of it. And so from that perspective, I've never been particularly worried about it in a gaming situation. It's been more so in the creative outputs.
In the design space.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. In the design space where you're really going out there and you're saying, this is the best I can do, right? This is me. I can't do any better than this. And sometimes that needs work. right? Sometimes that's not where it needs to be. And that is something that you need an incredible level of trust and be able to bring to someone else.
Wow, yeah, absolutely. You know, that's funny. You say that spiel like it's so obvious, like everyone says it, but not everyone says it. Mm-hmm. And not everyone makes that clear. It sounds to me like you're very intentional about the microculture of the table that you are trying to create. Mm-hmm. What other kinds of things do you do to create the gaming culture that you want to participate in?
Mm-hmm. Around the gaming table, you mean like while we're playing?
Sure. And then I'm going to zoom out. We're going to talk macro.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So we're zooming in now. Mm-hmm. The culture around the table is super, super important to me whenever I'm playing a game. And I think a large part of that is because Kate and I really have been playing in a scene in the San Francisco Bay Area that we're really trying to grow. Right? Mm-hmm. We have lots of friends who we think are just like bursting at the seams to be able to play in these experiences, right? They're all looking for this creative outlet of expression.
Yeah.
And so we're really trying to harbor that passion as best we can. And making sure that they know that this is a safe place and that this is not even somewhere that they have to feel vulnerable in, right? Like, this is somewhere where we're not judging each other. We're just coming and we're just sharing our obviouses, right? And smooshing them into each other. And being able to get people comfortable with that is, I think, the single most crucial thing in making sure that they have a good game. I know we've looked back in the past at playtests we've done that have either gone well or not gone well. And the biggest distinguishing factor by far that we just isolate all the time between the two is, did the people buy in? Like, were they willing to go out there and really like let themselves go and open themselves up into having a real fun and special experience?
Mm-hmm.
And that safety is incredibly crucial in order to be able to get that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so like, making sure that those expectations are set up front and also modeling it in your own style of play are kind of the most important things, I think, in order mm-hmm. to be able to accomplish that.
Mm-hmm. So buy-in is the crucial sort of keystone at the table.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, when you're talking about a community more generally, which you alluded to, you're trying to kind of build locally.
Mm-hmm.
What do those efforts look like when you say, like, I want to have a really good local gaming scene?
Mm-hmm.
What actions follow from that thought?
I think the things that follow most directly are making sure that you can have some very safe, nurturing environment that people are going to feel welcome in,
mm-hmm.
and that people are going to feel like, at least initially, someone is responsible for who they can come to in case they have problems, right? Mm-hmm. There's someone there who they can have a conversation with and who is actively thinking about whether or not they're having a good time, whether or not they're feeling comfortable,
yeah.
and whether or not it's a safe space. So that is very important to us. And also just that people realize that we're picking this based on people we love and trust first, right? This isn't because you're just so damn hilarious that we have to have you at the table, right? Like, that never happens. It's just, do we want to spend time with you, and do we trust you to be a good representative of this community going forward? And so it's that's always the first decision that we make. And then after that, it's reliability. It's making sure that this becomes a part of people's lives mm-hmm. in a ongoing regular basis, which is also super crucial. And making sure that people have positive experiences when they actually do come, right? When they make that risk, when they come try something that they don't know about, that they really walk out and have a special experience. And that has honestly kind of been the easiest part after the first two work out. I do think that this genre is just so rich and so many people are really deeply yearning for it that when you get them into the right space, the magic just kind of happens, right? And that's something that we believe.
How do you, what's your approach, or what are you thinking of and prioritizing when you have a new, like a first-time role player at the table? Because to me, that's like the precious, beautiful, mm-hmm. fragile egg that I must like nurture.
Totally.
Like, I feel very strongly about that. But like, what do you think, and what are you putting at the front of your mind when you know there's going to be a new person?
Mm-hmm. The most important thing for me is, well, really, the system and the other people, right?
Interesting.
The other people is really the first thing,
yeah.
I think, right? And making sure that it's a group of other people who are just going to be welcoming to them is obviously very, very important. Mm-hmm. But the system is also a super huge deal, right? How much are they going to feel in the spotlight? How much pressure might they feel on them? Which, though, you can tell them as many times, like, don't worry about it. Like, this is not a competition of creativity. This is not a place where you need to feel like you're being judged or anything. We just want you to have a good time. Mm-hmm. And while that gets through, I think some games versus others are harder to really be able to get people into that mode of play. And I especially like games, especially for people who are just starting out, that give players very concrete points at which they have narrative control, because that's really the opportunity for them to say, okay, you have explicitly given me authority in this setting, right? I can tell you as many times as I want that, like, hey, we're telling the story together and we all have narrative control. And that might not be something that really penetrates deeply yet. Mm-hmm. The one example that I always love bringing out, which is one of my favorite games to play with new players, is really like a simple version of Mouse Guard, where, you know, we won't do conflicts. We'll kind of simplify the rules down a little bit. But the thing that I think is so beautiful about that system for new players is the GM turn, player turn kind of separation.
Right.
Because first I'm taking a turn and I'm giving you very explicit challenges, right? You tell me how you get over the river that's over flooded, or, you know, there are crisp, you know, autumn leaves floating around. And it just leads them into this world of wonder that they're immediately kind of drawn into. Mm-hmm. And you're asking them these very direct questions, like, how do you do it? You know, tell me.
Yeah.
And like, okay, I'm going to try this. It's like, all right, well, we'll figure out how to see what happens. And if it doesn't work out, you know, something amazing is going to happen because of that. Like, we'll have an even better time. And that also gets them really accustomed to failing, too.
Right.
And how fun that can be. But then you do that, and then you give them, you move on to the player turn after the GM turn, right? Mm-hmm. You're in the town, you have some downtime, and you're like, all right, like, you have two turns. What do you do? Like, what's, and here's some examples. Like, you're hungry, you're injured, maybe you want to do something about that. But maybe you just really want to, like, find that bandit that got away and really show him what's what, right? Like, maybe that's super important to you.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful. Like, when players are given that choice between what they need and what they want to, like, that's one of the most fruitful places.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just love being able to do that in that system. And it's one of my biggest go-tos for new players.
Yep. That's so interesting. That's definitely not one of the first systems that I would think of, mm-hmm. but that makes so much sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the ones that are kind of more GM heavy a lot of times can be surprisingly good, I think, for new players, right? I'm able to go down there. I'm able to control the experience a lot more, where especially if there is someone at the table who, you know, I trust, but maybe on this particular day isn't being quite as generous with the spotlight, or is getting a little overeager or something like that. Having a place where the GM has a lot of authority does let you really cultivate that experience for the new player as well. So that's one of the reasons why I really love Mouse Guard in general. Yeah,
it's also very pretty. It's very easy to sell people on that. I know. Because they're look at these cute little mice.
Oh, and I always have a bowl of chestnuts to pass out. It's like little checks. Yeah, yeah. And so people are always playing with the chestnuts, and it's always super adorable.
Oh my god, that's so cute. Mm-hmm.
And the first time actually we played, it was right around Christmas, and I remember Kate had all these wreaths and green foliage that she had put up like behind her couch. Uh-huh. And so I took them down, and I decorated like the table with them. And she was like, okay, we can keep one of these on the table. Overall, this might be a little too much. and I said, okay, fine. So I took some of the wreaths off the table. So it wasn't quite as big of a jungle as I was originally planning. But it was still very evocative, I think. And given that I do try to bring in a lot of people from, like, improv or from acting and stuff like that, it is really nice to be able to give them a little something to hook them in, a little something to get them.
People like something intangible, whatever it is, whether it's tokens or cards or just something physical. Like, I think people in general, in like most situations in life, want to have something to do with their hands. Mm-hmm. Like,
absolutely. So I know that you think about this problem too, mm-hmm. right? You think about new players. You think about what to play with new players. Like, this is kind of a golden thing for you. What types of things do you think about? If you don't mind me asking and putting you on the spotlight.
Whoa, what's happening right now?
I don't know, but...
You know...
Is it okay? Can I ask you that?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I often think that a rules light system is going to be the best thing because then it's easy for them to get into. But what I'm discovering is that actually for new players, I'm learning that they're actually completely fine with a complicated system as long as you know it extremely well. Mm-hmm. Like you could be playing Burning Wheel and like, and as long as the person who's running it knows it inside and out, you're actually going to have a much smoother experience than playing something that is much more mechanically simple, but that everyone is kind of figuring out together. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge thing. And the other thing is that I can't believe how important it is that the fiction that the game refers to, like regardless of mechanics, the genre of it matters so much. Mm-hmm. I've been agonizing for years over what game I'm finally going to play with my dad, like how I'm getting him into role-playing games.
Totally.
And so I'm like, oh, Dread is like kind of cool and very tactile, or like, oh, this is like very simple, or like, this is kind of like, you know, accessible in this way. But I recently totally off the cuff said that I had, because he loves The Prisoner, the Patrick McGowan spy TV show.
Totally.
Yeah, it's very good. I just found out that there was an RPG system and it was based on GURPS. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, haha, there's like a Prisoner RPG system. And my dad was like, I would play that.
Yeah,
play I would it. Absolutely.
Bring that for me now.
He's like, can you play it? He's like, can you rent it? I'm like, well, it's a collector's item, so I'll probably never find it. But I'm like, God damn it. Like, that's what you want to play.
He's excited. Yeah, that's awesome. That's great.
So I'll never be able to learn. So yeah, I would say I used to say rules light, and now I just think I should just run people through whatever I know really well and whatever they're really excited about.
No, I completely agree. Like, I've been really surprised by how much people have been willing to defer in terms of, like, not knowing a system very much and how much they're willing to trust you. But really, especially if it's someone coming from, like, a D&D background or a more Triad background, it's like, there is so much trust placed in the GM at all points, right?
Hugely, yeah.
It's not even knowing the rules, although that a lot of times is part of the responsibility. It's like, I trust you not to just shove a gold dragon in, like, this third level dungeon that we're going through, right?
Yeah.
And you have narrative authority to do that. And so I have, in general, I don't think that this is even necessarily unique to just new players. I have been realizing that as someone running a game, like, I do have a surprising amount, like, people are willing to put a surprising amount of faith in me, even if they don't understand the system themselves. And that is something that is definitely in my understanding of how to bring in new players as well.
Totally.
Theme is super important. I'm really looking forward to hearing about you running this game.
I gotta track it down. I gotta learn GURPS. It's gonna be very, very good. I can't wait to report back.
I remember making my parents play Dungeons and Dragons when I was like in sixth grade.
Really?
Like eighth grade. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. How was it? How did it go?
It's one of those things that you look back on and you're like, wow, my parents really love me. Right? But it definitely at the time was because I was just terrible, right? Like, aww. I was a teenager and they're going out and they're doing this, and even then, you know, I'm being like huffy and they're not doing it well enough, right? Because I'm a complete shit.
That's
right?
So hard to picture. I'm learning about this, like, Shadow Hakan who used to be shitty.
Oh yeah, a little angsty.
Oh man, I actually wanted to ask you about how you got into gaming. I wasn't sure if you, because it's always sounded to me like you found it as an adult.
Oh, not RPGs and tabletop RPGs a little bit. But really high school it started. I grew up overseas. And I grew up in Istanbul from ages like 2 to 13.
Is that where you met Kate?
Oh, no. That was 2 until 13. We've been together for a while, but not quite that long. So I grew up in Istanbul, and Istanbul definitely had the fact, or definitely had a quality that I could not go outside, right? Like, that was not something okay for me as a child.
Right.
We lived on the fifth floor of an apartment complex, and it was like, you can go out to the grocery store sometimes when you're old enough, I was like 13 or something, that was okay. And then you have to come right back. And if you're not back at home in like 15 minutes after you left, then that's a problem, right? And so in that situation, really, I grew up very, very closely attached to my video gaming systems, right? Yeah. Like the Super Nintendo was kind of like the thing that I really grew up next to.
Yeah, the place for you to go.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Like the normal thing for me to do. And I also lived one floor above my cousin, who also played a lot of video games. And this was also some way for me to connect that much older relative. So my cousin was much older than me.
Right.
Like on the order of 10 years or so. So okay. Like we weren't hanging out or anything, right? I was like 13 and he was like 23.
Right. But if you have the shared language of the video game, then suddenly there's something to connect over.
Exactly. Exactly. It's at least something there. And we also, he was the first person who gave me a copy of A Player's Handbook. I remember he told me that he actually played in a D&D game in Istanbul. You know, he gave me a Turkish version of the handbook, and I remember reading it and just being kind of fascinated that this was a thing, right? And that there was this thing going on, like, once a month or so on the floor below. And I just remember being completely fascinated by that. Fast forward, and I moved to South Carolina, which was also a bit of an isolating experience for me, right? Mm-hmm. And because I didn't speak English very well, I was very, you know, very unacclimated to the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And eighth grade is a tough year for everyone.
For everyone. That's a bad time to have more.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So there, what I ended up finding was really going more into gaming and more into computer gaming was not only for a way for me to deal with that physical isolation, but also this was a point where connectivity was a much bigger thing, right? Mm. So I grew up, I went through those years with a lot of very close connections that I made through online gaming, like Age of Empires, Warcraft 3, stuff like that, right? And then at that point, I also made really one close friend throughout high school who later we would play D&D with, or I would play D&D with. And it was just the two of us, right? We were the only ones that we liked enough to play. And so we would switch off a little bit, but primarily he would DM and I would play. Mm-hmm. And so it was two players.
That's how we would love, only play. I love two player games. Mm-hmm. Like there's really, it's a really interesting experience.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really cool. And then he ended up going off to college a year before I did. And we started play by email, D&D Captain.
Cool.
And that has gone on for, we haven't responded in at least a few months now, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's at a bit of a trickle now, though we occasionally do still engage with it. We'll reintegrate it every so often. But that was, let's see, 11th grade, so I was 16, 14 years, something like that, right?
That's incredible.
Same character for that amount of time.
Wow.
Still 3-5.
Right? Yeah, like, that's right. That's, forever.
Yep.
3-5 exactly. Till you die.
Oh, yeah. We're not changing that system.
Yeah.
It's just way too customized at that point.
To move it must just be like a completely different thing at that point when you've been playing it for that long and hacking it. And
yeah. Exactly. And so that was, it was a big part of like me being able to stay connected with this friend of mine, especially as we would study abroad through college. So after high school, we also both went to the same college.
Mm-hmm.
And we roomed together for a lot of college. And when we studied abroad, I think actually it started while one of us was studying abroad. And, or at least the campaign in its current form. We played in similar campaigns in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and then later, as our lives somewhat diverged, it became a way to keep in touch then as well.
Right.
And he actually lives in Columbus now, so I get to see him when I go to Origins. So that's why I never miss Origins.
That's so great. Uh-huh. That's so, so great.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So you've been playing D&D all this time. That's a very long time. And then when did you start to get exposed to other games?
Very recently.
Interesting. How did that happen?
I got into board gaming in graduate school. Because someone showed me Settlers of Catan at some point, and I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
Right? And so I got into board gaming, really enjoyed it. And Kate is wonderful, and she got me tickets to Gen Con for my birthday one year.
Amazing. amazing.
Right? Because I love board games.
Yeah. Wow.
And exactly. And we had one friend who I played board games with, one of the closest board gaming friends I have in the Bay Area. And he said, hey, there's this super wacky thing called Games on Demand. Right?
Oh.
And he was like, you'll probably really enjoy it. And I was like, you know, I bet I will.
Yeah.
And so I went and I played... I think maybe you talked to Kate about this a little bit too. John Wick's Cats.
Yes, was like yeah, my first Cat. Oh my game. God, which is also a very, very special game in my heart.
Oh, yeah,
yeah, I've had good experiences with that game.
It's so fun.
Yeah.
And now, whenever we see our cats just like running around the house, we always talk about how they're chasing Boggins, right? Like,
yeah, of course. Yeah, it's all too plausible.
Mm-hmm. No, no, all the time. Huh. And then we played that, and we played The Quiet Year,
which is a beautiful game.
Oh yeah, and then at that point it was like, okay, the Quiet Year kind of blew our socks off.
Totally.
And we were like, okay, we're buying this. Mm-hmm. We're coming again to Gen Con next year, and we're only doing games on demand. Like, it's just...
That's a really valid Gen Con plan that I would recommend to a lot of people.
Yes, please do that. Don't worry about anything else.
Yeah.
I think I went to the dealer hall like once during the entire Gen Con, and it was one of my best Gen Cons.
Yeah.
It was just... Games on Demand, and I went to the National Security Decision Making, which is like just around the corner from Games on Demand, which is also Walk Up and Play.
Right, right.
So, and that was a really, really wonderful experience. And at that point, it was like, all right,
we're in.
We're like completely hooked at this point. And then we heard about Golden Cobra. Right?
Wow. And so then you made Sign, which is amazing. And obviously, everyone responded to it.
We were very happy.
Appropriately, due to its amazingness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now here you are. And it's about to be in so many hands and in print and out there in the physical universe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're extremely excited. And the thing that has really been outstanding for us is how welcoming everyone has been and how encouraging for new designers and really how much people were willing to put themselves on the line and really help us succeed. And it's something that I'm eternally grateful for like more people than I can list. Like, it's really outstanding. It's really just, there've been no shortage of people who really went out of their way to introduce us to other people, to vouch for us for other people when really they didn't even know us well enough to legitimately do that. But that was great. And, hopefully we haven't like made them too ashamed of their decision by this point. But yeah, so we've been just really wonderful. But from your response, it feels like you've had a similar reaction to this.
Oh, yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I'm just loving... I think everyone, when you find the kind of gaming and the kind of other... and the kind of players that you really love and you get to experience that and mm-hmm. get into that, it's so irreplaceable. Good. Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. We should run, but... Mm-hmm. Yes. But we could talk for hours and hours and hours. This is super fun.
I'm
really, really, really glad that we made time to chat for a bit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you so much, Alex. It's always wonderful to get a chance to talk to you.
Yay!
And this time it's recorded.
Now everyone gets to enjoy it, not
exactly.
Just us. Well, thanks again to Hakan for coming on the show. And as always, thank you for listening. You can keep up with Hakan at thornygames.com or on Twitter at @HSEYA. I also encourage you to go on Kickstarter and find Dialect and check it out. You will be very, very glad that you did. Remember that if you have thoughts on today's show, you can always reach me via email. That's backstorypodcast@gmail.com, on Google+ at backstorypodcast, or on Twitter at backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can find more great shows like One Shot, Campaign, Modifier, Talking Tabletop, First Watch, and Second Watch, all at oneshotpodcast.com. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more at soundcloud.com/Ujiko. That's UJICO. Talk to you later, heroes.